Case number 23580, Miguel Gillian versus Merritt Garland. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Nathan Bogart, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you for this opportunity to appear in front of you and discuss this case today in oral argument. My name is Nathan Bogart, and I represent the petitioner, Mr. Miguel Gillian. And for your information, we've reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
Thank you. May it please the court. The outcome sought by the government in this matter constitutes a significant shift in how immigration courts would apply the mandatory grounds of denial and removal proceedings, specifically the so-called persecutor bar. This shift would be in contrary to the plain language of the government's own regulations and the long-held precedent of this court as established in the decision of Diaz-Zanata v. Holder, published in 2009. The issue is important because the question of who carries the burden of proof to show that the persecutor bar is triggered and then how it is triggered is fundamental to determining how and when the burden of establishing that the bar should not apply is shifted to the applicant for relief. The regulations provide the answer to who has the burden of triggering the persecutor bar and other.
Are you talking about the burden of production here?
Yes, Your Honor. The burden of essentially the burden of triggering mandatory grounds of denial.
Well, I mean, I understand, you know, I understand you're making an argument about that. And there are reasons to think, well, geez, you know, the government should have that burden. But in any event, it seems like that burden is met here based on the testimony of Mr. Gillian himself. Am I mistaken about that?
Well, Your Honor, that's actually, I'm grateful for that question, actually, because I think it cuts really at the end of the day to the core of what we're arguing about. So our primary argument is that the persecutor bar should not have been triggered, that to the extent the Department of Homeland Security did have the burden of triggering it, there just wasn't enough evidence in the record to meet that threshold. And we get that just looking at the facts and comparing the facts of this case to the facts of other cases issued both by this court and also sister circuits when it comes to determining when the bar is triggered.
So this is a question about what that kind of quantum of evidence is as opposed to who must produce it, right?
Absolutely. Yes.
And so how would you describe that sort of body of evidence or that quantum of evidence? What's the test that you would advocate for measuring that?
Sure. So, you know, I think that at a minimum, what needs to be demonstrated in the record is that there is some nexus connecting specific activity of the applicant to actual persecution.
Okay. So there has to be identified persecution. In other words, you know, on this particular date in 1984, there was, you know, this sort of, you know, slaughter of defenseless prisoners during this battle they were having. And he was present at that time. I mean, with the government unit, that's kind of the specificity you're looking for.
Yes, Your Honor, more or less. So, you know, certainly there has to be some identified persecution that happened. And then, you know, that has to be connected to a specific action of.
How is that consistent with Parlak? Because I read that as saying that the guy there provided money, provided weapons, but I'm not sure there was the specificity that you're talking about here.
Sure. I think it is consistent with Parlak, but, you know, when you look at those facts, you know, I don't think that it's overly debatable that when you provide money and other types of support that you are providing assistance. And so if your money and support was going to an organization, for example, that was engaging in persecution, then there is an argument that you were assisting in persecution. So at that point, you know, the bar may very well apply.
Can I ask you a question? I want to go back just one step about the burden. What is, why doesn't the AG's opinion in this matter of Negussi take care of any question about who has what burden and whether the government has a burden or whether the evidence just has to indicate as the reg says?
Sure. So, you know, our position that as, you know, as far as the AG's decision goes in Negussi, when it comes to burden, that it was wrongly decided, it overturned what had been the board's established policy for quite some time. But when you look at the facts of Negussi, especially, and compare them to a facts like of the case that we have with Mr. Guillen, they just don't match up. But I think also as importantly, just taking into consideration the practicality of practicing before the immigration courts, the reality of the situation is there, the regulation provides no responsibility to the applicant for relief.
Well, doesn't the AG say the evidence suggesting the bar's applicability may come from either party? In other words, the government may put in evidence, but they don't have to. Now, if I were the government, I probably would put in some evidence, but I don't, I mean, it doesn't, but the opinion is clear. It can come from either party. And I'm a little bit, so I don't know. I mean, I know that it says, the one thing I know it says is that you have the burden to show that the grounds don't apply. And it seems like whatever the initial burden is, if it's on the government or it's not, you know, technically on the government, it seems to be a fairly low burden. I mean, the evidence has to indicate that the bar may apply. I mean, I don't see how they couldn't get past that burden here. I mean, yeah, it may apply. You're in a unit. They did some bad stuff. He, you know, was involved in reconnaissance. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff in the record here that I don't see why it wouldn't suggest that it may apply.
Well, I think it's hard to say that it may apply in this particular case just because the connection between the evidence that the department submitted in Mr. Guillen's case is just too tenuous. The vast majority of the evidence they submitted really did nothing more than establish that the civil war in El Salvador was bloody and that the military engaged in certain tactics that resulted in civilian casualties. But there were some pieces of evidence that did say that the 5th Brigade of the Salvadoran Army, which Mr. Guillen was attached to, and then its subdivision, the Canas Battalion, engaged in somewhere between 2 to 4 acts of human rights violations over the course of the 2 years that he was attached to those units. But we also have to put in context those units. The 5th Brigade had about 3,600 soldiers attached to it at any given moment. And the Canas Battalion had about 1,200 soldiers and officers attached to it at any given moment. And of course, during a time of war, you have several people cycling through due to casualties and reinforcements and things of that nature. And so really what you're talking about is saying that nexus is met by showing that Mr. Guillen was one of several thousand soldiers who might have been attached to a couple of human rights violations. The evidence just isn't there. Nothing is, and also there's nothing that attaches specifically to, you know, how reconnaissance squadrons operated. You know, did they commit human rights violations? There's just no information in the record to establish that.
So what kind of case law, I mean, that was very helpful, that detail you just gave us, but what kind of case law would you point us to for your kind of more specific nexus standard?
Sure. So I would look first at Diaz-Sanada and the facts of that case. I also think that the government cited to a Fourth Circuit decision called Pastor v. Holder, issued in 2013, that also discusses when the persecutor bar is triggered. And I think both of those cases kind of give us an idea as to when it's triggered and when it's not, when you compare those.
So those are kind of data points in your view, but they don't lay out the rule that you want us to adopt here.
Well, yeah. So Diaz-Sanada doesn't go into as much detail as we would like when it comes to discussing when the bar is actually triggered. They do cite favorably decisions of other circuits that do discuss when the bar is triggered. For example, Singh v. Gonzalez out of the Seventh Circuit. But it doesn't itself talk about it. And that's mainly because Diaz-Sonada was more preoccupied with establishing the elements of the persecutor bar.
Isn't the problem that there's tension here between the burden on Gillian to demonstrate that the persecutor bar doesn't apply and Diaz-Sonada's discussion of nexus and scienter? You propose a prima facie case necessary to establish, to trigger the burden on your client. But doesn't the issue really get down to what's in the record? And is there not a way just to look at the record without having to say that a prima facie case by the government is a necessity before an IJ can look to the record?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think there is a reasonable reading of Diaz-Sonada because most of the discussion does focus on what's in the record, what does it contain? You know, Diaz-Sonada wasn't overly preoccupied with burdens of proof. You know, the burdens of proof may be there, but at the end of the day, it does come down to what is in the record. And when it comes to Mr. Guillen's circumstances, there just isn't enough evidence in the record to trigger the bar. And even if there is, there's not enough to apply it.
What do we do, though, with the adverse credibility finding? I mean, doesn't that go to the heart of the case about whether he knew about atrocities and the IJ says he doesn't believe your client on any of that? I mean, why doesn't that go into whether the bar is triggered and it's certainly not rebutted then?
I don't think it goes into whether the bar was triggered because, again, the bar has to be triggered in order for the burden to shift to the applicant for relief. And so if the bar isn't triggered, his lack of credible testimony really isn't at that point an issue. But even going beyond that, even if it is triggered, again, you look at the record when determining whether or not the bar applies.
And isn't that the question here? Let's assume that it meets the regulatory requirement that evidence indicates a persecutor bar may apply, which is a pretty low threshold. But I guess the question that I would have is, did IJ Holt address these issues? Did that IJ look at nexus and scienter in making the determination?
Your Honor, may I reply to that? I know my time is out.
Certainly, go ahead.
Thank you. No, Your Honor, I don't believe that IJ Holt sufficiently reviewed those issues. She did not parse out those two elements, and she never really made a determination as to whether or not the nexus element had been established. And per Diaz-Sonada, the nexus element needs to be established in order to even shift to the question of knowledge.
Okay.
I'll save my time. Thank you.
Okay. You'll have your rebuttal, and we will hear from the government.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Paul Stone. I represent the respondent attorney general of the United States. The posture of this case is important. Guillen had already been found removable. The government had the burden to prove that by clear and convincing evidence. So now Mr. Guillen is seeking relief from his removability. So he has the burden. That's under both the statute and the regulation. The Supreme Court decision of Pareto.
Burden of production? How's he going to have a burden of production of showing that, you know, he's not eligible for discretionary relief?
Well, that, Your Honor, that's where the regulation comes into effect. The burden is on him. It's clear. However, the Attorney General issued this regulation, essentially carving out a small exception, saying you don't have to disprove every bar. There's many bars. It would really complicate matters to require applicants to disprove all those bars. So the Attorney General said, okay, if there's some evidence indicating the bar may apply, then the alien has to carry his or her burden to prove it doesn't apply.
Right. Okay. So that's a different burden. Burden of persuasion at that point, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
So why don't we focus on the burden of persuasion? You know, I mean, the government did have some evidence here that The petitioner belonged to this, you know, unit of the 5th Brigade, and they did a handful of bad things, apparently. But, you know, I mean, it's like he's the needle in the haystack or something, based on that evidence. Why don't, I mean, looking at Diaz-Sonada, I mean, our court there says the alien must have done more than simply associate with persecutors. All right. I mean, that would seem to be an answer to the evidence that you do have with regard to he was in this unit that did a few bad things over 2 years. And our court says there must have been some nexus between the alien's actions and the persecution of others. As far as the standard's concerned, why doesn't that support the petitioner here?
Because, Your Honor, that's not the standard for whether the evidence indicates. That's an extremely low standard. If evidence indicates
menace, I'm talking about the burden of persuasion at the end of the day.
Then we'll presume for a minute that the evidence indicates and that we agree on that. Moving to his burden, he actually had a very low burden because the evidence that the government put forward, while it showed.
Okay, no, I'm sorry. I got confused by the burdens. You're saying that this language doesn't apply to the burden of production?
The language that the evidence indicates.
This is saying you do need to have a nexus.
I'm sorry. The evidence indicates that the bar may apply. Doesn't require a nexus. It requires evidence indicating it may apply. It doesn't require evidence that the bar applies, which is very different. Under Pareto, which was just issued, which we discussed in our 28-J letter, the Supreme Court talks about what the burden means. And the burden means that even if the record is ambiguous as to whether the bar applies, and this court had Gutierrez, which said the same thing, that the alien still has the burden to show it doesn't apply. The burden in this case, we don't think was very insurmountable because the evidence, we don't argue, establishes all the elements of the persecutor bar because it didn't have to. So really what Mr. Guillen just needed to do was to testify credibly that he wasn't one of those soldiers that persecuted others. The problem is his testimony just wasn't credible, which is why he's pushing so hard to raise the bar here.
So your argument is anytime the person is found not credible, then they just lose, period. I mean, under that argument, that's all that's left. You're not credible, you lose. But doesn't that forget the burden on the government to have looked to the record and said that the record contains nexus and scienter, as Diaz-Sonada requires?
Your Honor, no, because what requires to put the evidence on the applicant is that the evidence indicate the bar may apply. We argue that does not mean each of the element needs to be present. That would be contrary to what burden means.
I'm sorry, but we're back in the same situation that we were discussing earlier. Where are we in the application of the standard? I don't disagree that evidence indicates the persecutor bar may apply will transfer that burden of persuasion to the alien. But that doesn't tell you whether or not you have satisfied the requirement of Diaz-Sonada that in the end, there is evidence on the record of nexus and scienter, both of which are clearly required. Well, by
Your Honor, that's because the alien has the burden here. The alien has the burden to prove they're eligible for asylum, so the alien has to carry that burden. If an alien lacks credibility, then, you know, the applicant can produce other evidence to show perhaps they were in another part of the country during this time, or that they weren't. In fact, but there are many ways to prove things in civil proceedings. But ultimately, applicants coming forward and being untruthful shouldn't be excused because the evidence indicates is set to such a high bar to protect them from mistruths.
You're not concern under this argument, as soon as there is finding of lack of credibility or a problem with credibility, under your standard, case is over. The case is over once they're not credible. And I don't understand how that would work. Why couldn't, I know I.J. Pizarre, the decision that he made was sent back for the for Holt to address what it means to have a finding of no credibility and it, to apply that and to answer that question. But it still remains at issue whether in taking it up that second time, the evidence reflect what Diaz-Zanata requires, which is some nexus and some scienter in the record. That's the requirement. Is that correct? Well, and if your record doesn't reflect it, then doesn't it need to go back to the IJ to, on the face of the decision, make that determination?
Well, no, Your Honor. Let me start with your point about credibility, which is that many applications are essentially over when the applicant testifies incredibly, fails to testify credibly. For example, asylum applications. One of the statutes says that asylum applications oftentimes are granted solely on the testimony of the applicant if credible. I think, Your Honor, the fundamental disagreement we're having here is that when the applicant has the burden, the applicant needs to actually disprove that some of the elements exist. Otherwise, essentially, the burden has been shifted to the government. The government has to produce evidence of every element of the bar applying. The burden on the alien does not mean the burden is actually on the applicant. So the applicant does need to testify credibly or provide other evidence that the elements are present.
Can the alien, can the applicant satisfy his burden by pointing to an absence of evidence in the record?
No, Your Honor. The applicant does need to produce some evidence that the bars don't apply.
And so the some evidence would be in a lot of cases, it would just be the testimony of the applicant, right? I mean, they might have other evidence, but in a lot of cases, you can't produce it. So it's just their testimony.
Right. And I'd like to point the court to the Pareda Supreme Court decision and this court's decision in Gutierrez. Neither decision had evidence showing those bars applied. The burden was on the petitioner to show that they didn't apply. The petitioner didn't provide evidence showing that they didn't apply. And so the Supreme Court and this court both said that the applicant was ineligible
Let me ask a question. So the evidence that you would say the government does have here, which distinguishes this case from those, is simply that he was a member of this unit that did like 4 human rights violations over 2 years.
Your Honor, I think that understates the record here. There's three general categories of evidence that were provided here. First, there was evidence showing that the tactics used by the Army of El Salvador during this horrible civil war didn't just result in civilian deaths. They targeted civilians. Civilians were part of the targets of these
war. Army of El Salvador. All right.
Right. So now we're moving down. There's three types of evidence. The next type is from the El Resate database. That database professes that it grossly underreports the number of human rights violations. These are the ones that reported that they were able to verify. And within that area, they identified 14 human rights violations committed by the 5th Brigade in Guyenne's area of responsibility. And they were able to identify the specific battalion in only 3 cases. I mean, this is the problem with war, is you have a hard time identifying individual things. But in each of those 3 cases, it was able to identify the battalion. It was the Cañas Battalion. So this is taking place in a war, which is not where persecution was routine. Extrajudicial killing was routine. Targeting of civilians was routine.
14 reports of violations by this Cañas Battalion, which is 1,200 people. And you're saying, and there's a recognition that this is probably a kind of grossly understated number.
That's correct, Your Honor. But again, the quantum of evidence is not high for the needing to indicate that the bar may apply. But this,
all right,
this certainly.
Judge Trant has a question. Hey, Judge, you know, when one of us starts talking, it's good to let the judge finish. Go ahead, Judge.
It's
hard. It's all right. But just to use the time efficiently.
I'm still struggling with the steps here. Each time you return to we're talking about that the bar doesn't apply or does apply, but I think we're beyond that. I would agree with you. Evidence indicates it may apply. Burden shifts. The question that Diaz-Zanata raises is then what is required to prove it? Because in Diaz, there was all kinds of terrible things that went on. And this, the person, she claimed that she was not a part of that, but the question is, what must the IJ then find on the record? Not that you have to produce it, because it's clear that the law is, you can get that evidence anywhere. It can come from Mr. Gillian. It can come from the government. It can come from other information pieces. But doesn't it have to be in the record in order? Doesn't the IJ have to make that determination and state that the record contains it in order to make that ruling? And that's a
great. Your Honor, I don't believe that we argue that if that were the case, then that would, again, that would shift the burden of the government. That would mean the evidence indicates is essentially rendered meaningless, because at that point, the applicant won't have any burden to show it doesn't apply. Any decision like that would put the panel in conflict with Pareda, Neguse, and Gutierrez, which all recognize that once that the applicant's burden is triggered, the applicant's got to come forward with something showing that the bar doesn't apply. Again, well, it's not a high barrier. It's not a high barrier.
Yeah, isn't Pareda just a call that ambiguity may go against the alien? And isn't that effectively what Pareda says? And that's fine. If there's ambiguity in the record, it may go against the alien. But the question is, what is in the record on nexus and scienter? I understand this. There's real tension between those two. And I'm asking you, how can that last step work if there's not evidence of nexus and scienter in the record?
Well, Your Honor, the way it works is the alien is truthful. If it's true that they weren't involved, part of the problem with an adverse credibility finding, like in this case, his testimony was all over the place concerning specifically the treatment of gorillas. He says they were sent to Canada, sent to Australia. When an applicant testifies like that, the agency is left not knowing what to believe. If the applicant actually were involved in persecution and told the truth, the evidence would be in the record. But when an applicant's untruthful, we don't have full evidence, and the government shouldn't be required to fill in those gaps that the applicant failed to fill in themselves by being truthful.
Mr. Stone, our opinion in Diaz-Zanata says, with respect to this, you know, kind of nexus plus scienter test or burden, whoever has to meet it. In the middle of this discussion, it says, second, if such a nexus is shown, so it's passive tense, it's not telling us who must show it, but if such a nexus is shown, the alien must have acted with scienter. The alien must have had some level of prior contemporaneous connection. And so I guess, I mean, like, you know, it says, if such a nexus is shown, I mean, how would that, it's saying that it's not an absence of proof on nexus that's required, but it's affirmative proof that meets the standard, that not only triggers something that meets the standard. And why in the world would the alien be the one that has to do the showing?
Because where we are in the case is it's the alien's application. The alien's asking for relief from the fact that they are removable. So they have the burden here. The government shouldn't be required to prove that it would be the, if you look at Pareto, they run down the four elements and they say, you know, the applicant agrees that they have the burden here, they have the burden here, they have the burden here, but denies that they actually have the burden to show that the I think it's the one of the criminal bars applied.
Okay. And then at the end of the opinion, it says the IJ must, I mean, this is in terms specific to this case, but it says the IJ must determine from the evidence in the record that during her employment with the Peruvian Intelligence Service, Diaz Zanata supplied information to the military that was actually used to persecute some individuals. And she knew that the information she supplied. So regardless of whoever, you know, who's got to meet the burden, whether, you know, it's saying the IJ must make these determinations. And were those, did the IJ make a determination as to nexus and as to scienter in this case?
No, Your Honor, the IJ didn't. Again, we argue the IJ didn't need to because it was the alien's burden. And the alien didn't produce any credible evidence that those elements did not apply.
I understand. Come on, you got to let me ask my question. So you're a Sixth Circuit judge. We have a Sixth Circuit published opinion that says the IJ must determine to apply the persecution bar to, so the production burden, whoever had it, has been triggered in this case, to apply the persecution bar to deny Diaz Zanata asylum, the IJ must determine from the evidence, blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, how do we reconcile that, command with the argument that the IJ doesn't need to determine this because he didn't sort of prove its inapplicability?
I think the big difference, Your Honor, is that Diaz Zanata, the court took the applicant at her word. The applicant testified she didn't actually assist in persecution. She didn't know about persecution. And the IJ failed to take that into account. And the court sent it back and said, look, you need to take these things into account. Here we have a different case where the applicant failed to testify credibly. We don't know what actually happened.
So you're saying, so the testimony was credible there, but not here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, that's helpful. All right. Thank you for your argument. Any further questions for the government? Okay, very good. We will hear rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. So from our perspective, Your Honor, burdens aside, we think the main problem with the government's position is that it's essentially making the argument that a mere association is enough to trigger the bar. And so if the Department of Homeland Security can go into an immigration court and say, you were associated with the Salvadoran military during the Civil War, now all of a sudden, it's the burden of the non-citizen to prove that these two elements of the persecutor bar do not apply to his application.
And well, we know Mr. Bogart, I mean, isn't it usually the alien's burden to demonstrate her eligibility for relief?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It is. It is definitely the burden of the respondent to demonstrate eligibility for relief. And that's typically done by demonstrating that they meet the elements of that relief. Mandatory grounds of denial are technically separate from the elements in the sense that, you know, if the mandatory ground of denial applies, we don't even get to the elements. You're just straight up
precluded. Right. And so are there cases that allocate the burden to the government for either this particular grounds of mandatory denial or of other grounds?
Sure. So most of the cases that we've discussed today do talk about at least the triggering, the burden of the government to trigger the bar.
All right, let's forget about the trigger burden. All right. Sure. We're talking about, you know, proving the nexus, proving the scienter, that sort of thing, the bottom line conclusion. Are there cases that say that for this mandatory denial type of thing, the government has to persuade the IJ, the government must persuade the IJ that the elements, so to speak, are met?
No, Your Honor, I'm not aware of any cases that specifically tell the government, you know, that they have to meet each of those two elements. Now, when you read Diaz-Sonada, as has already been pointed out, it is, I think, straightforward in the decision that the government could have submitted more evidence in order to demonstrate particularly the nexus requirement, which is very separate, obviously, from the knowledge requirement. And you can't even get to the knowledge requirement until that nexus requirement has been met. So the record as a whole, whether that comes from the the respondent or the government.
I don't understand. I mean, the IJ here made a very specific finding that your client had not carried his burden because he had not testified credibly. I mean, that it's a specific finding. That's evidence. Your testimony is evidence. And the IJ says, and it seems to be a pretty low burden if the IJ is just looking for credible testimony that you're not a persecutor. And the IJ says, you didn't carry your burden. I mean, what do we, doesn't that just kind of take care of it?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the precedent of the court does require that the evidence in the record reflects that there was a nexus.
But that is evidence, isn't it? The testimony of the applicant is evidence. So the evidence doesn't, because you didn't testify credibly, you didn't disprove the nexus or the scienter, right? I mean, that is evidence, isn't it? It's not a document, but it's evidence.
Of course, testimony is evidence, Your Honor. That is correct. That being said, even if we cannot take that testimony into account, you still need to look at the record and determine if the record reflects that there was an actual nexus.
But it's not just a question of taking it into account, right? It's making an adverse credibility determination. So if you testify, I didn't know anything about what was going on with my unit, and the judge says, I don't believe you, then the judge is implicitly or explicitly saying, you were involved because I don't believe your denial. I mean, would be enough, wouldn't it, to say, well, so then your nexus argument doesn't work and your denial about knowing anything. I don't believe you when you say you didn't know anything. So therefore, I'm saying you knew something, right?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because knowledge comes after the nexus finding. You have to have that nexus finding before you even get to the question of knowledge. So sure, if you testify incredibly that you had no knowledge and the judge doesn't believe you, that is an issue, but you don't get to that issue until you found that the evidence in the record indicates that the nexus exists. And there's just not enough evidence in this record to show any nexus between any action taken by Mr. Guillen and actual persecution. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay. All right. Thank you both for your arguments. The case will be submitted. And the clerk may adjourn court.
Honorable court is now adjourned.